On the line, I have Niall Stephen. Good morning, Niall, and indeed welcome to the programme.
And good morning to you, Noel. Thank you.
First of all, Niall, can I congratulate you on a wonderful programme there last Wednesday there? Because you really, I suppose, brought us back in time, back to the heady days of Fela 1990 up there in Tip, the trip to Tip, you know. It was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful to hear the music and to hear the Riot crowds and the whole lot. So again, as I said, congratulations to you.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. The idea was just because we're all in lockdown now.
Yes.
And, you know, whether you go out to a gig or whether you go out to the local bar or a game of golf or just a walk, you're kind of restricted.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just thinking it'd be nice to have a virtual night out, or in that case, a weekend, and throw in a bit of history, you know, something that, you know, would resonate with a lot of people that went to the Fela. It might have been their first festival. It probably was a lot of people's first festival because there had been a gap between festivals from the Shimses, from Lisconvern, and then the Fela was kind of the resurrection of the festival mentality again. So
yes.
I just thought that people would remember it fondly. And, you know, just I thought, sure, we'd try it.
It was absolutely wonderful to go back in time, and because, as I say, you know, it is something I suppose that we kind of forgot about now. It was so long ago, I suppose, really. But like to go back to the pre-COVID days, to go back to the age of innocence, I suppose, more than anything else, you know, when we were all young and foolish, I suppose, and everybody headed off to trip the tip, you know. And like when you look at it, and then just before we leave it there, the trip to tip, when you think of the bands like Meatloaf appeared there, Hot House, Flowers, Van Morrison, Deacon Blue, Mary Black, The Saw Doctors. You had a brilliant lineup there, hadn't you?
It was, and that was the first year.
Yeah.
And, you know, it got stronger and stronger.
Yes.
After that. You know, it was a great mix of an international profile as well as a homegrown. Like, if you look at No Sweat.
Yes.
That was their first album. I'm not even sure if they had released the album at that point. They maybe had a few singles out. But there was the quality of just the homegrown Irish music there was phenomenal.
Yes.
You know, the Saw Doctors, Christy Moore, Mary Black, you know, and, you know, An Emotional Fish, Hot House Flowers, Van Morrison. You know, it was just such a strong presence of Irish music. It kind of outnumbered the international acts.
Yes.
And you're kind of going, it just shows you the pedigree of homegrown Irish music that is still there today. It's just not as profiled the way it would have been in those days, you know.
Yeah, and of course, like you had an added advantage that you were doing on the sound desk for a lot of those, weren't you?
What actually happened was MCD came up with the idea, Dennis Desmond and MCD, and the Hot House Flowers manager, Robbie Wooten, and Dennis got on quite well. So the Hot House Flowers crew kind of took a lot of the production aspect of it on board.
Mm-hmm.
So we had, I had worked with a few bands, and Norman Verso had worked with a few bands. So a lot of the bands down through the years we had associations with. So it was kind of easy for us to fit in because we knew their crew, we knew the band members, we knew the artists, you know, some of the international artists, Deacon Blue and things like that, we didn't know as much of. But a lot of the Irish artists, it was just like, it was like a party with all your friends
Yes.
that came along, you know. So it was a special time.
Yes, yes.
Because suddenly these bands that had been doing small gigs and, you know, like McGonagall's are...
Yes, exactly. When you say small gigs, in confined places like halls. But this was the first big open-air event. And the atmosphere there, looking back, the atmosphere there was electric, wasn't it?
Oh, it was phenomenal. It was absolutely phenomenal. You could almost bottle it. It was electric. And, you know, I'll always remember... We were staying on a tour bus at the back of the stage because you couldn't get anywhere to stay.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, after the show, you might go for a bag of chips just to walk around the town, and the atmosphere was electric. People were, it was a phenomenal atmosphere. The town embraced it as well. You know, they knew what was coming and they embraced it. So it was just a weekend to remember. And you know, as you were saying, it was kind of the rebirth of festivals in Ireland.
Yes.
And a lot of it, I will put down to how that festival was run, because it was kind of, if it was run bad or didn't work out well, it would have been detrimental for any plans for the future.
Yes.
But because it was so well run, so well, you know, the audience were so well behaved, the town accepted it so well, it was just a no-brainer that it was going to happen again and get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well, that's the thing. Like it was so successful that it was a mighty hard act to follow in the preceding years, wasn't it?
Mm. Well, it was and it wasn't. And the reason, because it became so... The bands, you know, like bands talk to each other.
Mm, yeah.
And you know, well, what were you doing last weekend? Well, I did this new festival in Ireland and it was amazing. And then that band, what? The Failure? Oh, yeah. And then the next year, the agents would, you know, ring up a band and say, look, they're doing this second Failure. It went very well last year. And they go, oh, hang on, I remember that. Oh, yeah, I'll do that.
Yeah.
So it kind of self-propelled itself into what some bands would like to do.
Mm.
And, you know, there was also, you know, in London, there was the Finsbury Park, and in Scotland, they had Tea in the Park.
Yeah.
And a lot of it had the same sort of ideas.
Yeah, and of course, it was Ireland's answer to Glastonbury, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes. Well, Glastonbury was the daddy of them all.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And, you know, if you look at, some of the bands that played Fail and some of the bands that played Glastonbury, they're probably a bit too big for a festival.
Mm.
But because the name was the Fela, or the name was the Fla, or the name was Finsbury Park, or Tea in the Park, or, you know, Glastonbury,
yeah,
you had to do it because it was kind of such an iconic place to play.
Mm.
You know? And, you know, like even in Cork now when they do the Marquee, the bands that played in the Marquee are way bigger than you should be putting in the tent. But
yes,
because the atmosphere and the name that gig has got, it attracts Elton John, Neil Young, Sting, you know?
Yeah.
And like
international names, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, and they're not doing it because, you know, they're playing to 25,000 people less than normal. They're going there because the name is... has traveled through the kind of the ether of music, and they've realized this is a great place to play.
Yes, you know? Yes. So,
and I think Fela was the same. It started snowball for festivals.
Yes. Where would you think that festivals, in your opinion, where would you think that festivals like this would go from here?
In the COVID or
post-COVID, no, we're talking about public. Obviously, there'll be nothing done in COVID, but after all this COVID business is over, you know, where does the likes of, did we say, Fail in 1990, now, where does it go from here?
Well, I think it will probably get, during Fail in 1990, the main source of band income was still selling records, selling CDs, selling cassettes. And that isn't really...
That's God, no kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah. So where bands in the 90s and into the beginning of the 2000s, I suppose, sold records to make money, now they have to sell tickets.
Yes.
So I think two things. I think you'll always have big bands that just like the atmosphere of an outdoor festival. There's something very kind of free about it. It's not as... organized, you know, people are going out there, they're going to see a number of bands, they're going to see a headliner, they're out for the fun. It's not as organized as just a one night show when you appear and you go and play. There's something festive feel about it, you know.
Yes,
and
yes.
I think that will be captured in years to come. And I also think because the way the industry is developing into a few quite strong monopolies that are running it, the smaller bands, you know, in the 90s, you might have a band like an Emotional Fish or like No Sweat that everyone locally knew were going to be good. They were a good band, great presence, good songs. All the boxes were being ticked. And then the record company would go to the radio station or to the local promoter and say, look, we've got this really good band. Can you put them in a support slot or an opening position and just give them a bit of airplay and a bit of presence? And then in years to come, if they do make it, you know, we'll remember. And that happened in Slane. You had Oasis opened up for a band. They were the first band on. 3 years later, they headlined it.
Yes.
Robbie Williams, the same. He opened up for, it might have been Oasis, but he opened up for a band and 2 years later went and headlined it.
Yeah.
Same with Kings of Leon. So that has kind of disappeared a little bit because local promoters are smaller and smaller, being squeezed out by one big umbrella organization.
But this is this is actually a repeat of, I suppose, what we saw back in the 50s and the 60s with the radio stations, when you would, we say, few radio stations, few and far between, like Luxembourg, Radio Luxembourg. Everybody listened to Radio Luxembourg, but you had the likes of Philips and Decca practically commandeering the airwaves and pushing the small bands out, hence the pirates.
Yes, absolutely. And the one thing about art in general, and certainly music, is monopolies don't work with them.
Yes.
If, you know, it was to the detriment of record companies that bands found a new way around it. It's the laptop with the Pro Tools rig.
Yes.
So
yes,
you have incredible songs, like Hozier recorded his album in the attic.
So the record companies
kind of got pushed to one side. Because the creative element of it is a growing thing. They'll find a way, you know. And I think in the future, a festival will give an opportunity for a small band who wouldn't necessarily get the coverage to have a wide audience and get, you know, where a lot of people will notice this band they've never heard about and suddenly they catch their eye.
Yeah.
You know? I think that's a positive out of it.
Yeah, it's good. It all goes good for it. Niall, I want to ask you about your next sojourn on the airwaves, which will be a halcyon days of the discos and the disco music.
Well, you know what? If there's ever someone who can come up with bonkers and crazy ideas, it's myself and Morris O'Connor.
Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. I tell you, got 100% for that one. 100% for that one anyway. Yeah.
And I think it's partly because it's our naivety. We haven't done a lot of work on radio that we're kind of, like, you know what, when you're talking to two grown adults and you see them talk to each other with ideas like they're two teenagers, as you know. So
yes.
The next one is disco. And it's about disco because disco was the prominent, disco and funk were the prominent music at the time. But it's really, it's a trip or a journey or a reflection of the 70s and 80s. And because the 70s was the time where music, except for some, not mainstream, but not all music crossed the Atlantic.
There was
a kind of completely different character or different source, different vibe of music being played in America than there was in Ireland and even in the UK or England.
Yeah, because you had a situation, I suppose, in the 70s where disco in America kind of grew out of, Motown, and was a follow-on for Motown. It was a speeded-up version of Motown, for want of a better word, and it developed its own generic. Where in England, you had a slightly, dare I say it, a more traditional look with the likes of the Beatles, the Bee Gees, that kind of thing, you know? So you had a little bit of a difference, all right, didn't you?
Absolutely. It was more generic funk. The disco was kind of created, as you were saying, from a Motown funk sound in the US.
Yes.
Not so. It was kind of more a rhythm, a dance rhythm in Europe.
In
you know, if you look at, say, I don't know, ABBA, for instance, the European, it was disco, but it was kind of a different disco. It wasn't as a funk-driven disco as it was across the Atlantic.
Well, you had the heavy influence of soul, I suppose, and
yes,
in England you had that northern rock music kind of influence coming in on that. Like, so they developed, but they did, towards the end of the 70s, and they did seem to merge together, didn't they? It was a slow process, but they did seem to merge.
Yeah, and the next show, the disco world, we basically go back to, I suppose my teenage years in the local parish hall disco.
Yes.
Where the DJ would pull up in the car, set some lights up and set, and then you would go in there and dance your heart out for 2 hours, you know?
Yes.
And of course, you know, when you were 15, it was a different vibe. If you did it now, you'd need a chiropractor the next morning, you know?
But, well, yes, definitely, I suppose, definitely. You know? Yeah, yeah.
But so it explores that from hoping people will remember the local parish hall disco, and then, you know, in the 70s and early 80s, and then we'll take a trip over to nightclubs in America, into New York, and what they were doing about the same time. And then the kind of crossover for me, anyway, I could be wrong, history might be a bit more accurate on this, but for me the crossover came strongly with, well, pirate radio, as you were saying. Pirate radio station had syndicated radio shows like Rick Dees and Casey Kasem that did the top 100 in America, and that started the crossover. But when MTV came aboard,
video killed the radio star.
The Buggles, and that started a whole migration from one continent to the other, and vice versa. It wasn't just America to the UK, it was, or America to Europe, it was Europe to America as well.
Yes,
and it gave a kind of, music was in two dimensions, but then it's brought music into three dimensions where you were visually looking at it as well. And it kind of changed the platform, because suddenly there was a much broader appeal to songs that wouldn't have necessarily even got on the radio playlist. You know, so that I felt certainly had a big part in the transition of music, because all during the 70s, disco was quite strong.
Yes.
And it was fairly similar, you know, a fairly similar approach to music, you know. But then in the 80s, you had an influx of a new sort of disco music. And then almost the week that MTV started, you had this influx of a lot more varied musical talent that was on display and you could listen to. So I think MTV was a good part of changing our view on music,
our perception, I suppose, of music, you know. Plus the fact, I suppose, and as we mentioned there earlier on, the advent, especially here, I suppose, in Ireland, for the Irish music scene here, because when you had the influx of, we'd say, pirate stations and the county stations and the national stations and the BIA, etc., etc., when all that came up, before all that, like, literally, the Irish, I suppose, the average Irish person, young person, in the very early 70s, listening to music, you had possibly two choices. You had reception, we say, varied reception from Radio 1 in England, and you had Luxembourg by night.
Yeah.
And that was about your lot, you know, throughout the most of Ireland. So basically, you listen to what they played. Nowadays, it's completely different, as you say, with the advent of computer and the advent of YouTube and the advent of Spotify and all these sites that you can get instant music anywhere of your own liking. So I suppose at the time, disco goers, I suppose, and young people going to discos, they basically relied on what the DJ had in his box. That's all.
Yeah. And a lot of that was controlled by how the record companies released the records. It might have been some record companies who would release songs in England and France and Germany, but not in Ireland, you know?
Yes.
So at that point, you were kind of there were a few shops that you could buy, you know, records that weren't necessarily in the chart yet, but not all of them. And I could understand why, you know, you don't want something sitting on the shelf that isn't going to sell. But you were as a consumer, you hadn't got a huge choice, especially if you wanted disco or the mainstream. That's what they held in stock. But if you wanted something a bit offbeat, you know, you had to go to specialized places, you know.
And I
think that changed when in the 80s.
Yeah, and the amazing thing about it, while you had a situation with, say, especially in England and Europe, parallel to the disco scene and coming up, I suppose, towards the end of the disco scene, you had, we'll say, punk and that kind of rock coming on board as well. So you had two different genres of music on stream there, hadn't you?
Absolutely. You know, yeah, you had a number, and they were very segregated in a lot of ways.
Yes.
The punks didn't like the rockers. The rockers
didn't
exactly.
like the mob. Yeah, yeah. Mm.
It became almost like a cult following. And I think that was because they had to fight so hard to get access to it.
Yes.
You know, if you became a punk or a rocker, you got completely into that and you knew where you could get the records. You knew where you could get, you know, all the memorabilia you needed, and you knew where the people that followed that music was, you know?
Yes.
So I think it was kind of, it was communities of rockers and punks, and for a long time, never should the two meet.
Twain should meet, because, as you said, the punks hated the rockers, the rockers hated the punks, and they all both hated the disco scene, so, you know.
Yeah, they all hated the disco.
They all hated the disco scene, yeah.
You know, but I think I was just, you know, every generation is something that the younger part of the generation, as it grows up, gets hungry for, you know.
Yeah.
The Beatles were completely, you know, the kids that loved the Beatles, their parents hated them.
Yeah.
You have to like something the parents don't.
Yeah, well, that was all part of growing up, part of the rebellious attitude of the teenagers, etc. Niall, can you tell me, this particular programme, I suppose, is coming on, it's about a trip, I suppose, for our generation. It's like a trip down memory lane, a trip with true nostalgia, because if you hear a 70s record there, if you hear some 70s disco music you haven't heard for a long time, you're instantly transported back to that time and the memories associated with that time.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
When would the program... So, sorry, go on. Yeah.
And the memories, they can bring a smile to your face. It can be heartbreak, and the people got married, you know, met their boyfriend or girlfriend at the disco, and now they're married with a bunch of kids, and they'll be sitting there going, do you remember that song? You know?
Yeah.
But funny thing is, I've got a couple of nieces.
Yes.
And typical young nieces, they know everything about music, every single thing. And they sat down and they were listening to what I was doing, you know, and they were going, where'd you get that? And I said, oh, you know, that was Chic, you know? Oh, really? And they started getting well and well into it. So I do believe, in a funny sort of way, that good music transcends generations.
It does. Now, it does.
To them, it's a whole new listening experience, listening to disco.
Yeah,
you know?
Because we associate, like, we listen to modern music now, I suppose. Our generation now listens to modern music there now, and we say, you know, you have a 76-piece orchestra inside in a little box, literally. That's what you have, and it's all synthesized, etc. Like, whereas, and I suppose every generation said the same thing. I remember my parents saying the same thing. In our day, it was decent music. Now it's all rubbish, rock and roll, etc. All rubbish, you know. But I suppose, look, that's the generations, the generation game. I suppose that's the generation gap, and it'll go on and on and on. I suppose.
Now, I don't think it's stop for us.
No,
it won't stop for us. And then after the disco, after the 70s and 80s disco show, we're going to look at some movies.
Oh, lovely, lovely.
Yeah, we have an idea to do, you know, some movies had better sound scores than others.
Yes.
Some, you know, soundtracks. But the thing that was interesting is actually how clever some of the sound scores were, the musical scores. And so you know you're listening to some dialogue and some music from a movie that you watched.
Yes.
And it was amazing how much it brought back.
Oh, yeah.
You know, even without the visual of it, you know.
So all you have to do is listen to the soundtrack there of The Good, The Bad and The Ugly, and straight away you know exactly where it's from.
Yeah.
You know exactly where it's from. It's an intimate. Yeah. You know exactly where you're going to, where it's coming from, and you're honed in straight away on the movie, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
Niall, can you tell me any ideas when the programme will be aired for our listeners?
It's the 11th, the 18th and the 25th.
Ah, yeah.
11th, the 18th. Now, I will be doing a little introduction, so you'll hear
we'll hear
a bit of advertisement on it. And I'm working today. I'm working on it. See, I'm learning as well. You know, it's an opportunity for me to listen to stuff which I haven't heard for a long time, and some of it I haven't heard at all ever.
Yes.
And we're working on something for the Grand Ole Opry from Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh, very nice. Yeah.
And it's, you know, probably the world's number one country and music, honky-tonk and bluegrass venue in
yes,
the world.
Yes, yes.
It started on the 28th of November, 1925.
Right.
And it's impossible to fit all the highlights into one show. You'd be a week and a half, But we were lucky to... I found a recording from the first artist who played on the Grand Ole Opry.
My goodness.
And he was the first member of the Grand Ole Opry. It mightn't be the song that he played, because obviously there was no recording equipment.
No, not until 1925 anyway, but any recording equipment would be probably shellac disc or something like that or whatever, you know, gone, you know.
I think this might have been recorded on an Edison cylinder.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
before the discs came out,
because the discs, you kind of had to go into a bit of a studio to press a disc, but you could actually carry this humongous thing around the place and record on the Edison cylinder thing. So I don't know for sure, but again, I'm learning things as I go along. So hopefully we'll have a show, country music, basically.
Great.
How the pioneers of that going back 95 years. So
That's got to be absolutely fascinating. And the last man I think that went back 95 years there was the late but great John Kennedy here, because actually he was in possession of an old cylinder recording machine, you know. And many times he had it there in the gossip shop there on the North Main Street, but sadly that's gone. Niall, listen, it's been wonderful chatting to you. We could chat all day, but as the saying goes, time and tide is against us here on the programme. Again, can I thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about forthcoming programmes here. And incidentally, if you have missed that programme that was on last Wednesday, as I said, they're all about the heady days of the fair in 1990. I do know that it will be repeated in time to come here. It will be repeated, so stay tuned for that. Niall, thank you very much for coming on and chatting to me.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Niall.